Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio. You may know Lawrence Wechsler for his unique approach to topics such as imitation culture, representations of war in film, and the history of May Day. As director of the New York Institute for the Humanities at NYU, he has led big think conversations on any number of subjects, often bringing them onto our show as well, for which we've been extremely grateful, the latest of which is solitary confinement. Ren joins us now to discuss this new project, and he's brought a few guests. Brayton Breitenbach, you may know, is the poet, painter, human rights activist, and the author of The True Confessions of an Albino Terrorist, a memoir about his seven-year imprisonment in apartheid South Africa. Also with us is Taylor Pendergrass, a senior staff attorney at the New York Civil Liberties Union and co-author of Boxed In, a year-long investigation into extreme isolation in New York prisons. Ren, welcome back to WNYC. Brayton and Taylor, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Thank you.
So, Ren, you're not a judge or a lawyer. Why, as an author and thinker in the humanities, are you turning your focus to solitary confinement?
Well, for starters, it's just such a scandal. Conservatively estimated, there are 80,000 people right this minute individually in solitary confinement. That is arguably, in the United States, arguably more than any other place at any other time in history. By comparison, there are 300 in Canada. And I was trying to figure out some way to bring this to public attention. And one of the things I always do in my things is to figure out how do you get people who aren't already going to the things. And in this particular case, I decided to ask the question of all kinds of artists, people like Tony Kushner and Mike Daisy and Josh Fuhr.
Who are all going to be at this event,
tomorrow,
the Cantor Film Center tomorrow.
Yeah, tomorrow,
right?
Yeah, on 8th Street. Well, we'll give the details later on where. But from it's an all-day event, one of my wonder cabinets. And I'm going to begin by saying, should you ever find yourself in solitary confinement, how do you think you would survive? And starting around 11 till about 3, we're going to have this cavalcade of artists and playwrights and so forth talking about that. But then around 3, we're going to pivot to talk to people like Brayton who actually have been in solitary confinement.
Right.
And then toward the end of the day, we're going to talk about the actual legal situation.
And we'll get in a minute to when it may or may not ever be actually justified. But Brayton, as Ren just mentioned, you're one of the folks who will speak tomorrow who has actually spent time in solitary confinement. And I wonder if you could just talk first a little bit about the experience of it and how you can communicate that to people who've never experienced it.
Well, you know, I suppose I'm lucky in the sense that I write and I paint. So I'm not sure whether that should be considered to be lucky because one tends to transform your experiences to make it available to other people.
Did they let you have pen and paper?
No. There was nothing like that at all. It was a tiny little cell. I could literally touch the walls if I stretched my arms to both sides. There was a warder outside the door whom I was not allowed to speak to. The lights were kept on all the time. It was a hard bunk. Your food was being brought in by a flunky shoved to the door, and you literally had no contact with the outside world whatsoever. I think one of the first effects is that, other than the reason why you're being there and the self-questioning and the self-doubts that arise from that, the closeness, the proximity of the walls and being deprived of all kinds of human interaction, you realize how extremely important it is to continue having a tactile sense of differences in texture and colors and voices, etc. So you're being deprived of all of that. And I think one of the first effects that this has is that it starts, it puts you into a kind of situation where you start hallucinating. You start hearing voices in your own mind, obviously, you imagine. And in this particular instance, we're talking of maximum security prison in Pretoria in South Africa at a time when people are still being executed at a rate of something like 7 a week. And one could hear the voices of the people who were going to die in a few days' time. You heard the reverberating echoes down the corridors of people singing the last night before they're going up to be actually executed. So yes, it was an absolutely horrifying experience that I certainly did not expect, and I'm not sure, not even as a writer or as a painter, having been equipped to face it. But there is one thing that made a difference. one had a sense, however much one pitied oneself and however inadequate one felt, however much one doubted the purposes for one being there, I had a sense that there were people outside knowing about me, knowing about my situation. I was being supported. I was being carried through somehow, even if I didn't or wasn't allowed to know this. And, of course, one had a sense that you were being part of a historical movement, of a historical change in times. This was because of my political activity. I wasn't there for having killed anybody or anything like that. I was a political prisoner. And that in itself was a source of comfort.
Can I ask how you have come to understand, or maybe you understood it at the time, why you were sentenced to solitary confinement? Not all prisoners, not all political prisoners met that fate.
Well, I don't think I was actually sentenced to that. It was never a formal proceeding. The proceeding was in at those times, and probably still the same, unfortunately, even now in South African prisons, that if you're being convicted of a political crime, though ostensibly political convictions no longer exist, but if you end up in that situation, you're being kept separate from everybody else for the first 3 months of your incarcerated period. In my case, it was just extended to 2 years. It only became later on during the second trial at the end of that two-year period why this happened to me. They'd assumed, this is the security police and the intelligence people, that I hadn't come clean on everything I knew, particularly not on the networks and the people that I knew, and that I would ultimately break, and they wanted this to start
so
happening.
So it was a form of interrogation.
Of course.
A form of torture.
I'll ask a question now then that I was going to ask later. Taylor from the NYCLU, do you consider solitary confinement in its very nature a form of torture or not necessarily?
Well, you know, what we explored in our report, Boxton, looking at the New York context, and I think what's important to understand when you talk about whether solitary confinement violates international human rights norms is a little bit of the scope and widespread use of solitary confinement, which I think a lot of people don't realize. In New York alone, the prison system has 5,000 solitary confinement beds. Over 13,000 sentences to solitary confinement were issued last year. And unlike Brighton's experience, in our report, we talked with over 110 men who had spent anywhere from 6 months to 22 years in solitary confinement. They were sent to solitary confinement not because they were the worst of the worst, but for breaking very minor, often petty, prison rules. For example, we spoke with prisoners who spent 4 months in solitary confinement for having too many postage stamps, 6 months in solitary confinement for refusing to return a food tray. So when you compare that against the very punishing isolation and extreme deprivation that comes along with solitary confinement in New York, it absolutely violates fundamental human rights standards. And it makes sense, of course, that at this event tomorrow, we'll be relying on artists and people who have experienced this kind of deep punishment to come to grips with what we're doing in our state and in the United States.
We're talking about solitary confinement with Lawrence Weschler from the NYU Institute for the Humanities. He's convening an event tomorrow at the Cantor Film Center downtown on this. Also with Brayton Breitenbach, who is held in solitary as a political prisoner in apartheid South Africa, and Taylor Pendergrass from the New York Civil Liberties Union, which did a year-long investigation on extreme isolation in New York prisons. Ren, you were going to say?
Yeah, I was just going to say that one of the people we're having tomorrow is Juan Mendez, who is the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture. And he will talk about international standards, and he will say in so many words that solitary confinement over extended times is a form of torture and is understood as such all over the world except apparently in the United States.
Taylor, go ahead.
And what Juan has highlighted in a recent report is that when you look at the way that solitary confinement is used in U.S. prisons, including in New York, you're looking at a threshold of about 15 days at maximum before it starts to raise the most fundamental questions about human rights violations. And in New York, the average sentence to solitary confinement is 5 months, and many people spend years in those conditions with complete social isolation and complete deprivation.
Defenders of solitary confinement will argue that it's a necessary tool, at least sometimes. For example, in curbing the spread of violent prison gangs like the Aryan Brotherhood. So, Rand, Taylor, Brayton, whoever wants to answer, do you reject that in all cases? And if so, what alternatives would you suggest?
Well, there's a very important distinction to be made here, and that no one disputes that if you have a, you know, someone in the prison system who is so chronically violent or so vulnerable that they need to be separated from the general prison population, that that's a tool that correction officers can exercise and maybe should exercise. But that's quite a different question entirely from whether when you have to remove that person from the general prison population, you're going to lock them in a concrete box 24 hours a day and remove all human interaction. And it's simply not the case that that is at all necessary. And in fact, what we found in our report is it's both counterproductive and used entirely unnecessarily. Only 16% of the sentences in New York involved infractions that had violence or other kind of aggressive behavior that would even kind of rise to the level of needing separation. And then when prisoners are separated and they're locked in a box for 24 hours a day, what we found is it only makes it worse both for the prisoners and for the corrections staff.
Many of those are people who are mentally ill, and we've criminalized mental illness in this country. So you put people who are already mentally ill and are violent, and then you put them in solitary confinement, they get even crazier.
And you know, one of the terrible effects of being in solitary, as I've seen happen to other people under similar circumstances, that you turn this perhaps what could be potentially a violent behavior towards others, you turn it in upon a person himself who is being held in solitary. By the way, I should perhaps mention that there are different forms of solitary confinement in the South African prison system. There's a political isolation, as happened in my case. But if you then infringe on some kind of a minor prison regulation, there would be added to that solitary confinement what we call spare diet, for instance. You'd be deprived of food for a number of days. And that is normally done under medical supervision. So it's actually quite horrible the way nutritionists and psychiatrists and medical personnel are being employed by the prison authorities to make sure you don't actually die while there. But I've seen this violence being turned inward, and the prisoners kept under those conditions would do everything possible to self-destruct or to draw attention to themselves. They would try to swallow, for instance, the spoon that they are being issued with to eat the food with. All kinds of incredibly horrible self-mutilatory actions, which I think is an objective correlation of what actually happens to you under solitary.
Here's a comment on our webpage. Somebody writes, I recently attended a talk with Damien Eccles, one of the West Memphis Three. I was struck by something he said about how prisoners in solitary confinement go crazy, which is a bad idea because after they serve out their terms, they're released back into society. Listening to his account, I was left with no doubt that solitary confinement is torture. And let's take a phone call. David in Manhattan, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, I've got a question, and I don't mean to be glib, but having never been to prison, I feel like I'd be really afraid to be in the prison population, and I feel like I feel more secure in isolation. Is that a condition that other people find themselves in? Am I overrating that? Is being part of the prison population not quite as terrible as I imagine it to be?
Are you saying if you're like this white middle-class guy who goes to prison maybe for a financial crime or something like that, and you're in there with all these street people, that you would be afraid of getting roughed up?
You know, I don't know. You hear stories about rape. You hear stories, and not just a white collar. What if you're just somebody, you know, did something wrong and you found yourself committed a crime?
Right. Prison is a fearsome place for anybody, Taylor. And you did mention that condition earlier, that some people are put in solitary for their own protection.
That's right. And that, of course, still remains available and should remain available even after we abolish this kind of extreme forms of deprivation and isolation that have become such a feature of our mass incarceration system. If someone is so vulnerable and is scared to be in the general prison population, there's no reason that a correctional official can't provide that person protection, but that does not mean putting them inside of a box for 24 hours a day. And I wanted to address also the comment that was made online and just contextualize it. In New York, 25,000 people are released from prison every year, and they come back to our communities. About 60% of the home communities for people who are released from New York prisons is the New York City metro area. And what we discovered by looking at the data from the New York prison officials is that about 2,000 people every year are released directly from solitary confinement back to the streets. That is, they're released directly from 23-hour-a-day lockdown, no educational programming, no rehabilitative therapy, no substance abuse therapy. Mm. They are literally given a bus ticket and told to go back home.
Brayton, can you address the other part of that listener's comment that was posted about Damien Eccles, who spent many, many years in prison for a crime that it turns out that he didn't commit, on how solitary confinement makes you go crazy. How do you prevent against that when you're in the situation?
Well, I'm not sure. You know, I used to say I can't look at myself as some kind of proof of having survived, because I'm not sure I'm not crazy. I think what it does to one, there are long-term effects that perhaps are more visible to outside, to people close to you. They notice when you come out. For instance, I was totally disabled, and, you know, I couldn't open a door by myself. I couldn't open a window. I couldn't cross a street. I know that perhaps even now still, I probably profoundly distrust any form of interaction that I have with other human beings. There's always a hidden motive somewhere. You know that you use yourself, you pretend to be as sane as possible, and you use yourself as an instrument. So I don't think it should be underestimated at all. They profoundly modify your psychiatric makeup during any length of period. But in prison in general, you know, we used to say in South Africa, the only thing that prison does, it makes a prisoner out of you. You become institutionalized. And all the other things we talk about, the potential dangers of being raped, and, you know, all that kind of thing, yes, all of this is true. But the basic essential fact remains that prison is not there to rehabilitate you, it's there to punish you. And at best, it turns you into a deeply damaged human being.
I was just going to say that part of the design of this event that we're going to be doing tomorrow at the Cantor Film Center at NYU is precisely to ask a bunch of people, mathematicians, scientists, bug experts, all kinds of things, how they think they could keep from going crazy. And so for the first 3 hours, we're going to have someone talking about how you could befriend a bug. We're going to have a mathematician about mathematical things you could do. We're going to have the Yes Men talking about how you could be a political activist in solitary. Oh. We're going to have Mike Daisy talking about how you could become a monologist in solitary, Tony Kushner, that kind of thing. And part of the, I think, the drama of the day is going to be that suddenly at 3 o'clock we'll hear from people who've actually been in solitary, and it's going to turn out that none of that's of any value at all.
The stark reality that we found, of course, in speaking with so many people who have spent time, you know, sometimes years in solitary confinement, is that the emotional and psychological toll that it takes is just absolutely devastating. We had a number of people actually attempt suicide during the course of our investigation, and the voices from people who have spent time in solitary confinement cells in New York prisons is highlighted in our report, which is available at our website, www.boxedinny.org.
And why do you say in that report that the practice is bad for corrections workers as well as inmates?
Well, you know, this is an interesting point, and I think it's often overlooked. But we, in the course of our investigation, spoke with corrections officials who have walked the halls of these solitary confinement facilities, and they see firsthand that locking someone under these conditions, especially people with mental health problems, especially people who are struggling with substance abuse, only exacerbates the behavior that got those people in there in the first place. And many of our corrections officers who are working in New York prisons are working there with very little training and very few resources to manage the very complex human psychological consequences that come when we use these practices. So, you know, other states that have recently enacted reforms, Colorado, Maine, Mississippi, who have dramatically reduced their populations of solitary confinement, have found that the prisons have actually become safer places to work for the corrections officials when solitary confinement is used much, much less.
And I'll mention that we have a link on our page to the Boxton report from the New York Civil Liberties Union and to information about the symposium tomorrow. If you want to see it at WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehr Show. But in our last just 15 seconds, Ren Wechsler, is there anything else you want to say about getting tickets or how you get information?
It's free and first come, first serve. We start at 10:45, and at 11 o'clock it's going to be Tony Kushner talking about how you might use the imagination to keep from going crazy.
And related information and streaming online?
It won't be streamed online, but we will eventually have it posted at the New York Institute for the Humanities.
Lawrence Wechsler, director of the New York Institute for the Humanities at NYU, Brayton Breitenbach, and Taylor Pendergrass, thank you all very much for talking about this with us.
Thank you, Brian.